From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in May of 2015 in the DMZ, the demilitarized zone separating North and South Korea. An American activist and academic named Brinton Likes joined 29 others in a walk and in two peace conferences there. Likes wanted to understand how people, especially women, had suffered, and she learned things that she had not heard reported often or at all elsewhere. This is part of the ongoing story that Brinton Likes tells as she travels the world, that what we hear in Western media doesn't always represent what we find on the ground, particularly in oppressed communities, war-torn areas. Likes tries to use cultural sensitivity and understanding to find better ways forward instead of simply applying American or Westernized standards. She's in Rochester as a guest of ROCLA, the Rochester Committee on Latin America, receiving their White Dove Award tonight. She's the co-director of the Center for Human Rights and International Justice and a professor of applied developmental and educational psychology at Boston College, among many other things that I could probably read half an hour reading, but I'm going to stop there and just say hello to Brinton Likes, who's our guest on Connections.
Hello, and thank you very much for the invitation to be with you today.
And it's great to have you here. And also here is Tom Ward, who is chairman of Guatemala Partners at Gates Presbyterian Church and a member of the steering committee for ROCLA, which again is the Rochester Committee on Latin America. Tom, welcome to you. How are you?
I'm fine, Evan. Thank you for inviting me.
You got an event tonight. Why don't you briefly tell us why Brinton is in town right now? What's going on tonight?
Well, the Rochester Committee on Latin America was formed back when Augusto Pinochet had a revolution or a military coup in Chile. And so we're going back over 40 years, and this organization has been here. And about 35 years ago, we started the White Dove Award so that we could recognize people that, such as Brinton Likes, that are out there on the forefront working for the oppressed people and trying to make the American public aware of our foreign policy and how it affects the people in these communities.
What title do you give yourself first, Brinton? Activist? Psychologist? Something else?
I call myself an activist scholar. I have spent my life very much trying to listen deeply to the people on the ground who have experienced some of the repression that emanates from authoritarian regimes and is all too often supported by the United States, but also to document in their words some of the impact of those experiences and to work with them to look at ways of making change, building a better life in the wake of that impact. So I started out with a methodology developed in the Southern Hemisphere in Colombia with a sociologist named Orlando Falls Borda and an Indian by the name of Anuzar Rahman, who developed something called participatory action research, looking at partnerships with local communities to help identify problems from their point of view, reflect upon them, analyze them, and take actions together. And now that's iterated into a way of trying to combine activism and scholarship. Some academics think that that's absolutely antithesis to the detached reflection of the university. But for me, it's bringing the resources that we've had the privilege of developing within mostly northern universities to engage in conversations and to learn through listening deeply to people on the ground.
So I want to ask you just to start by giving our listeners one particular example, any example you choose, because again, you've traveled so much, and then we can kind of talk about broader themes. But what's an example of where this work has been applied?
Okay, so I have worked actually now almost 30 years on and off in a rural community of the northern Quiché in Guatemala called Chajul. And I first went to Chajul invited by a young woman I had met in Mexico who was a refugee there. She's from that community, and she had seen some of the work I'd been doing with Mexican refugees. And she wanted me to go up and meet with a group of women, some of whom had been hiding under their beds during the armed conflict there, others of whom had been in something called the Communities of Populations of Resistance. The Quiché region is a region where over two-thirds of the 660 documented massacres that took place in the early 1980s, mostly in Guatemala. And in that context, I facilitated a small workshop with nine women for the first time. And the women began to talk about wanting to build a better life for their kids. The war was still going on, and in the process of talking with them, they suggested to me that they wanted to build a corn mill. And I asked them, I said, well, I'm a psychologist. I work in psychological, psychosocial areas. And they said, well, this is a mental health project. And I said, a corn mill is a mental health project. It was beyond my thoughts. I had no idea how a corn mill could possibly be a mental health project. So instead of saying, no, that's not a mental health project and I don't know how to do this, I said, I don't know how to do this, but I'm happy to accompany you in the process of figuring out how to do it. So for them, what the corn mill was about was creating a resource for the community. There was only one mill in the town, and women spent 4 to 6 hours grinding corn by hand in order to make tortillas in order to feed their families. And secondly, they thought if they could build a mill with a generator, so when the little bit of electricity that the town got went out, they could run their mill, they could make additional money, and then they could invest in an educational program for their children. And that would make them feel better as widows who had lost their husbands during the armed conflict. So I began to think about Western psychological ideas that have a hierarchy in which you need to meet basic needs before you can move to spiritual and psychological needs. And for these people, the material and the spiritual were all woven together in the same project. So the corn mill became a mental health project. We applied for funding, actually, and got a little money. And in the process of building the corn mill, these women explored ways of being in the world that were transformed gender relations. So they went out and cut down the tree, which women had never done before. They actually learned how to run the machinery. And every time they confronted something that they had never done before, they experienced a lot of fear. They didn't want to talk about the war. They didn't want to talk about losses from the war. So we did dramatic play and workshops using creative resources that I had learned in Argentina in an earlier iteration of my work. And as they dramatized being afraid to go out and cut down a tree, we did dramatic multiplication, and the fear and anxiety from the war began to be dramatized. And so it there's an Italian pedagogue who worked with kids, autistic kids in Italy, named Gianni Rodari, and he talks about entering the house through the window. It's sometimes a lot more fun than going through the door. And my experience in a lot of my work is I have a tendency, I've learned how to assert myself and to go right through the front door. And in fact, many times it is a lot more fun and you learn a lot by going through the window.
So what are some of the ways that we tend to mistake understanding conflict, how conflict is impacting populations? You know, what are some of the pitfalls that you sort of commonly see?
So I think one of the most impactful contribution that psychology and psychiatry has made over the last 30 years in many ways evolved from and emerged from our response to veterans returning from the Vietnam War, in which we as a society, there was an enormous amount of activism in opposition to the war, and there was a lot of tension and conflict as veterans returned from the war. And I think, although there is, if you look back to writing during the First World War, you see antecedents to the notion of trauma and the notion of post-traumatic stress disorder. But it was really in work with Vietnam veterans that the psychological and psychiatric communities began to define and articulate what they considered to be a traumatic effect of war. And the notion of post-traumatic stress disorder entered the parlance, and it entered the diagnostic and statistical manuals, and it became the way of working with the impact of war on civilians and on soldiers. And it was exported to other parts of the world. So as humanitarian crises began to be identified, as it became very clear that there were large numbers of children in Guatemala, to take an example, whose parents had been massacred and who were orphaned, the idea that we needed to take that diagnostic category and take it to Guatemala and diagnose kids as traumatized and as suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, or take women who had suffered sexual violence during armed conflict. My sense of that strategy is that it is a strategy that's deeply historical, deeply contextualized within the United States, and that it doesn't translate easily into other contexts. So it didn't mean just moving from English to Spanish and having something that culturally was responsive. My experience working with indigenous populations, first of all, is that their understanding of their lives are 500 years long. They look back to colonialism, and they look back to their communities prior to the colonization, and they have a different understanding. Many of them have a different understanding of time. They see time more as cyclical. They have a different understanding of their ancestors and of those who have been disappeared. And they have now there are many things we can learn from those other experiences, but I think as a cultural and community psychologist, one of the lessons learned is that it's not just a question of knowing that people have different cultural beliefs or different languages. It's learning how to listen to the knowledges that are generated out of those beliefs and then finding a bridge, finding a connection, finding ways to draw upon the knowledge from their context and ours. So I think the notion that everybody's traumatized or suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. The second thing is that for most of these people, this is not post. The war in Guatemala went on for 36 years. They're also living in extreme poverty in most of these communities, where, unfortunately, the poverty today is sometimes worse than the poverty that gave rise to some of these armed conflicts. And as psychologists to deal with the impact of war, we don't pay enough attention to the economic violations in people's lives when we pay more attention to the political violations.
Now, I cannot try to accurately and intellectually embody your American colleagues in psychology who might want to push back a little, but let me try.
Go for it.
Because they might say, well, are you saying that PTSD is not a valid concept? Are you saying that that kind of stress isn't clearly and obviously impacting children who become adults? And what's the formulation you're making about? Are you making a statement about PTSD writ large, or is it as it impacts different communities?
I'm saying that PTSD is a marvelous construct. It's made a huge contribution to the health and mental health care system in the United States. It's created resources for veterans that are absolutely essential and that need to be sustained and continued. But I am also saying that it's a construct that was developed at a particular historical moment in response to a particular set of conditions, and that we need to recognize those particularities. There's a wonderful critical psychologist by the name of Erica Berman who's written a book called Deconstructing Developmental Psychology. And she looks at the major theories that have been developed in the West through psychology and psychological research with primarily white, middle-income, college-educated students, not exclusively, but primarily. And she says these are useful ways of understanding the world, but they are ways of understanding a particular world with a particular set of populations, and we need to think more about these particularities. It is true that I am in a profession that argues that there are universal processes that underlie many of these outcomes. I myself think that there are particular realities, historical realities, and that over time, I do have confidence that we're going to be able to talk about some of those universals, but it's not until people who are white, people who are privileged, people who are educated in the West learn to listen more closely and more deeply to some of these other realities. In terms of the communities, one of the extraordinary things, for example, about working in Guatemala over many years is that the Mayan communities have survived 500 years of colonial invasion and imposition, and they still have numbers of 22 different languages. They still have beliefs and practices, and they have a lot of mestizaje, mixing. There isn't a pure Quiche or a pure Ishil or a pure Ladina. That is, there is a lot of mixings of communities, and that generates what some colleagues and I in South Africa called a third voice. That is, it's neither the voice of marginalized, excluded Mayan peoples, nor is it the voice of a Western U.S. psychologist, but it's something that gets, knowledge that gets generated in the interstices of this.
What is the most important lesson from the fact that this is a population that has survived, as you say, 500 years of colonialism, maintained all these different languages and aspects of its own culture?
A real lesson for me as a United Statesian is to look at the indigenous populations right here in the United States and to begin to understand more about what our colonial history is and how we created policies and practices that destroyed many of these languages, many of these cultures, and killed thousands of native peoples here. That's one very important lesson. The second important lesson is, and it's based a lot not just on the survival, but on the protagonism of those communities that I've had the privilege of working with, is that there's an enormous capacity to transform, to learn from experiences. During some of the worst years of the armed conflict, when there were so many massacres in the northern K'iche', there were populations of people who fled into the mountains, and they eventually became public as the communities of populations of resistance. And I've been reading more now of some of the oral histories that they themselves have put together from those experiences. And it's quite remarkable. These are people who continued to be bombed by the military, and the military continued to try and take them as prisoners. And yet they were from Mam communities and Kamhobal communities and Ishio communities. And so Spanish was the language they had to learn in order to communicate with each other. But they developed a communitarian system, and they worked the land together in order to survive. Many of them didn't survive, but the ones that did. And it showed a creativity and a resilience that I think is impressive. It's not without its contradictions and problems, and those contradictions and problems, I mean, war leaves many legacies. And the community in which I worked, and worked with an group of women who set up their own organization, developed a number of economic development projects, educational projects for kids at some point over the last 20 years. They could not manage conflicts that evolved, and they split into two organizations. I mean, war leaves enormous legacies. It's not a perfect world under any circumstances.
My guest for the hour is Brinton Likes, who is the co-director of the Center for Human Rights and International Justice and a professor of applied developmental and educational psychology at Boston College. In town tonight as a guest of ROCLA, the Rochester Committee on Latin America, and they have an event tonight. And I want Tom Ward from ROCLA to tell us a little bit about tickets still available tonight for the event tonight?
Well, they sure are. And we're looking forward to host anybody from the community that would like to join us. Gates Presbyterian Church very graciously allows us to use their facility for the dinner, and we have a lot of seats still available. And we have Peg Gefell from Savory and Time. Well, she had Savory and Time on East Avenue, if you remember it. She's doing the cooking for us today, and it's going to be delicious. We're also, besides Brinton, as our international award winner, we're going to be honoring two other organizations. One is the Dreamers from the University of Rochester, a very contemporary topic, and we're going to recognize their work and their efforts. And also a local farm worker organization, the Alliancia Agricola.
All right, so that's all tonight, and it starts when?
Doors open at 5:15, and the church is located at 1049 Wegman Road.
That's Gates Presbyterian Church tonight for the event, and you can get more information at ROCLA, R-O-C-L-A .us, if you'd like more information. So, you know, Brinton, you mentioned that a couple of concepts that I want to explore a little bit with you. You talked about whiteness. You talked about understanding privilege. I'd like to know, given the span of your career, how much you think about those things, how much you need to think about those things when you travel, and have you always thought about those concepts? Is it more lately, or has that always been part of the work?
Very important questions. I haven't always thought about those constructs, but I think about them often, and it's a critically important part of my work, and I can talk about it in two different ways. The first, I'll talk about it more as discovering I was a United Statesian, which was when I first started working in Guatemala, and the U.S. military was involved in training some of the Guatemalan dictators and military who we now know were absolutely responsible for many of the massacres. And I worked in rural communities with people who knew a lot about where the funds were coming from that was supporting their own military. And they had a lot of skepticism about relating to someone from the United States. And I entered that community through solidarity networks and with an assumption that I was on their side. And they related to me very clearly as I was an outsider and I was representing another side of a conflict. And
not to be trusted?
not to be trusted, not to have anything to offer them, not to and not to have any right to be there in some ways. And it was a slow conversation. And it depended entirely on who introduced me into a community as to how I was received in that community. And I think I had lived in France as a college student in 1968, and I became aware of myself as a United Statesian in that environment through the student and worker movements at the time. But I think it was a very important awakening to how I define myself and how other people define me are not always the same, and that I have to be about listening to how they define me and listening deeply to it and understanding why I was defined that way. In terms of white privilege, I grew up in the South. I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana, and I am old enough to remember signs that said colored and white as a child. I might have not quite registered the civil rights movement as a white person from an upper middle class family that was well educated, except for a family accident of history in which one of my mother's relatives was involved in having refused to integrate the public schools when they were integrated and got excommunicated from the Catholic Church. And all of my cousins were taken out of the Catholic school that we were in together. And it registered in a family way, and I began to have a better awareness of black-white relations as a child. I didn't understand that I had white privilege. I think I had a better sense of my economic privileges from the Catholic upbringing that I was raised in. But as I moved through college and got more involved in political situations and worked in Appalachia for a period of time, I became much more aware of whiteness and being white, and I began to participate in workshops, anti-racism workshops, and I met through that process a number of people who had been trained in anti-racism work through the YWCA and the YMCA, and for the last 20 years, I've been working with a group called the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond, which is based in New Orleans, Louisiana, and they do undoing racism workshops. I'm part of a coalition in Boston in which we host the People's Institute for a workshop every fall. I work with all the students who take my participatory action research class are required to participate in the Undoing Racism workshop. And for me, it's all about learning how racism has been constructed in this country. It's been threaded through our institutions. And if as a white person I want to develop collegial, collaborative partnerships, solidarity partnerships with people of color, with African Americans, with Mayan indigenous peoples, I need to undo racism every day in my interactions with people. My siblings joke. They ask me why I have to go. I'm going now to my 18th undoing racism workshop. They say, "Kevin, I learned yet how to undo racism." I think it's a life project. I think it's something what I say to them is we drank the water of racism as we were growing up, and we were completely unaware of it. And so I think it's critically important that we not see these issues. We don't see racism as a black problem. It's a white construction, and it's a way in which power has been harnessed to privilege some of us and to marginalize large numbers of us. And it's playing itself out with other populations of color as we move forward in this country.
So whether it's a sibling or a friend who says you're going to your 18th, and if they were to say to you, well, look, Brenton, I haven't been to any. I can't do a whole workshop in 5 minutes or a short conversation, but can you give me one guiding point that I can keep in mind that would help me?
Yes. Well, I'll give you two. One is I think I like the language of undoing racism. Because I think it says it's been done, and it's been done to all of us, and we all suffer. And the second is that one of the principles that's discussed in this 2.5-day workshop has to do with internalized racial superiority and internalized racial inferiority. These are ideas that come from psychiatrists and psychoanalysts. Franz Fanon has written about this and from his experiences in Algeria and France. But the notion that I have developed ways of being in the world out of that superiority. For example, I'm also an oldest a second child out of a 9 siblings, and I'm the oldest daughter, and I'm a good organizer. And I easily tell people what to do. I've sort of overcome my female shyness, and I know how to give direction. But I have a notion of what organizing is and of what facilitating a group is about. And it's a notion that comes from a way of processing information that's connected to that experience of feeling like I know more than other people in the room. So I can be in a committee of diverse people, of people of color, where I'm one of two white people, right? And somebody will send out an email. And nobody will answer the email, and a day will go by, and a second day will go by, and I say, oh, I have to answer the email, right? Because I'm the organizer. I know how to tell people what to do. And I send out the email, and then an African-American colleague says, you know, why are you always the first one out to tell us how to take the next step? And I realize that that's a way of being in the world that is connected to these experiences, not just of being white, but of having economic privilege and that there are other ways of organizing, and that I need to pay attention to those, and I need to be held accountable by people who will say to me, that's your internalized privilege. But I also need to know how to say it to myself. I can't expect other people to call me on the carpet. I need to build solidarity. Maybe I'll give you a third thing, and that is that a lot of white people don't like each other, and they don't like each other to hold each other accountable. We don't think we can learn about racism from other white people. And so we put the burden on blacks to teach us about racism. And that's a difficult, and we want to be the special white that blacks think know about racism. We don't want to be the fool who makes an idiot of themselves in a racist way or a prejudicial way. So we don't call each other. We don't hold each other accountable.
I think on that point, you know, there's many, many local stories I could probably draw upon, and I won't pick out any single one. One comes to mind, but I won't mention it offhand. But bottom line is everybody has had experiences in which someone will do something that seems pretty overtly racist, and the person who committed the act will say, often a politician, but I have no racism in my heart. You know, this was a misunderstanding. The audio tape that I didn't know would be released to the public doesn't really represent what's in my heart. As if there's only two doors people walk through in life, racist and not racist, instead of, it's a sliding scale, isn't it?
Oh, yes. And it is in the water that we drink, and it is in the institutions that we are part of. And we have to learn how to understand ourselves as whites and also we have to learn, I think, what our own ancestors gave up in becoming white. Many of us come from traditions, Polish, Italian, Irish, groups of people who were discriminated against when this country was in its early years. And there's a book, How the Irish Became White. There's another book, How the Italians Became White. And I think as whites, we don't recognize what cultural linguistic practices our parents or our grandparents or our great-grandparents gave up to become white. And secondly, how much it's impossible for African Americans to become white in that same sense. And then thirdly, how groups coming into this country today don't want to give up their languages. They don't want to give up their cultural practices. And that actually is experienced by many of us as a threat. It's not just that we think they have to learn English if they want to be part of this country, but it's anxiety producing to think I only speak English and they speak three languages. Or I lived in South Africa and the Zulu people spoke 6-7 different languages. And I was teaching in a university of predominantly white people who only spoke English. And yet they had 20-30% of the students in their classrooms could speak 6 languages.
But we are at a cultural moment where there is an ascendancy. I don't want to overstate it, but certainly there is a more public comfort with being alt-right, with being white nationalist. We see it in Fox News evening host Tucker Carlson has a segment a week saying, what's wrong with wanting assimilation? What's wrong with demanding this? Shouldn't we? In other words, one of the questions he raises, and I only raise it here, not to endorse Tucker Carlson, but because there are millions of Americans who say he's right, and they say, well, what is a country then, if not a set of sort of common norms and experiences and often languages and cultures? What would you say to that?
It's a very provocative way of framing the question. Well, I would start with my own lived experience and the ways in which my life has been enriched as I have been welcomed into communities where I haven't always been able to speak the languages of people. I've had to rely on people to interpret for me in numbers of Mayan communities. I would also say that I think it's, pragmatically speaking, I think there are a lot of good reasons to push for the possibilities of learning a single language to be able to operate in the commons with each other. At the same time, I don't think deciding to share a language means giving up the language that I learned as a child. I think there's a sense, we have this sense of it's all or nothing. It's what you were saying earlier. There's one way, and it's always a binary. And I think we, one of the things that I've learned from the enormous opportunities I've had to live in a number of different contexts is that the world is not polarized, right, left, good, bad, evil, good. It's lots of grayness in life. And I think that I think we are living in a moment in this country where we don't tolerate the gray very well. And I think that it's very, very challenging to talk across some of the chasms that are being generated. And I think that we need more leadership in places like this kind of a conversation or through the media to be able to open conversations across some of what are becoming chasms that are not going to take us forward as a country, and I think violate some of the many values that many of us think this country has.
After our only break of the hour, which is coming up in just a moment, we're going to talk about how our guest perceives the immigration debate. She has worked with communities. She'll tell you more than I will, but the bottom line is, you know, you've worked with communities that have really suffered in a lot of different ways, and you have done a lot of work studying, writing about the impact in different ways on separation, family separation. There's so much. But before we get there, one more question on this point, because our listeners raise it sometimes, which is, do we talk too much about white or racial privilege and to the detriment of talking about class or economic privilege? How do you see those two factors, and do we not talk enough about economics?
I think that's a critically important question. I draw a lot on some of my colleagues, particularly African-American colleagues from the 1970s and the Kwame collective. I think we have to talk at the intersections of race, of class, of gender, of sexualities. I think that we are living in an historical moment in this country that has led to the so-called 1%, but probably 10 to 20% of a population that lives in conditions that are so completely much more privileged than the vast majority of the population. We see poverty in our urban centers, in our rural communities, and we need to talk at the intersections of these issues. We need to recognize that the majority of poor people in this country are white, not people of color, because they're the majority of the people, even though the populations are shifting in some parts.
That's what I'm thinking, because I worked in West Virginia for a number of years, and I know a lot of people in some very poor communities who would say, yeah, I'm white, so what? You're telling me I have privilege? You know, don't tell me I have privilege. I've heard that. What do you say in those moments?
I think that's a particularly complex reality, and I actually work with colleagues who are very progressive politically and who have worked in communities, and they would argue that poor whites don't have white privilege. I think it's easier to see how wealthy African Americans are discriminated against. You know, you have friends and colleagues who can't get a taxi in New York City because they're black, or get profiled in suburban white communities. But I think that it's critical. I'm not sure I would hammer the issue of white privilege with economically marginalized people. But I would say that despite the intersection of these privileges and marginalizations or oppressions, that there is a privilege as a white person, even in the most marginalized of economic conditions, but you don't live it on the day-to-day. It's not how you experience life for the most part, particularly in Appalachia, West Virginia, and other, in some parts of the United States.
My guest is Brinton Likes, the co-director of the Center for Human Rights and International Justice and a professor of applied developmental and educational psychology at Boston College. She's in town today to receive the White Dove Award from ROCLA, the Rochester Committee on Latin America. There's an event tonight. 5:15 is when doors open at the Gates Presbyterian Church on Wegman Road, and tickets still available. You can get online right now. ROCLA, rocla.us. That's rocla.us. If you're interested, Tom Ward is here. He's chairman of Guatemala Partners at Gates Presbyterian Church and a member of the steering committee for RACLA. Let's get that only break and come right back here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, where are the women of color in American journalism? It is still an underrepresented field. American newsrooms are very white, and women of color in particular are significantly underrepresented. What is the impact? What does that do to coverage of important stories or stories that are not covered at all? We discuss it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It's already 12:42. The conversation's flying this hour, covering, and we're not going to be able to cover everything I wanted to talk about with Brenton Likes, but I do want to ask about the current immigration debate, because you know we could do hours on this subject, and to some degree we have, but given your work around the world, given the nature of the conversation in this country that is not always nuanced when it comes to immigration, or never nuanced, let's put it that way, I want to start by asking you about sort of policy in Washington questions, and then I want to talk more about your experience in different communities. Let's start with policy. What's the best case scenario you see, what do you, in terms of policy right now coming out of Washington on immigration?
It's hard for me to see a best case scenario coming out of Washington on immigration. I think that we've had multiple opportunities to push forward a comprehensive immigration reform. And they have passed us by, or we have passed them by. And I think that the current administration is so profoundly unpredictable in terms of its inclinations in one direction or another. And our Congress has immobilized itself in terms of immigration. I think that there are hundreds of thousands of young people whose lives are being held in a balance that is looks like it has no resolution. I personally think the latest iteration from the White House of sending the military to the border is one of the worst possible moves. And I think that further militarizing an already complex situation where more and more people's families are being split and lives are being lost as people seek to survive is a horrific idea. And I think that the I think we need to move towards a comprehensive immigration reform. And I also think financially it's a lose-lose situation to try and deport the huge numbers of people in this country. I mean, economically speaking, we need these workers, and it's an extraordinary mistake to use our funds to deport them.
Well, now let's turn to a scenario that's not as likely as others, which is you get a call from the White House, and you find out the president is a big fan of your work. He's going to be at RACLA tonight. He wants to hear more from you. And he says, you've got my ear, and we're going to craft a legislation on immigration. But what rules, what does need to be in place? What does an ideal, forget about the ideal situation that you think is feasible now. Let's start from scratch. What should the immigration system look like?
I think we should have a route towards citizenship for the people who are currently living in this country. And I think we should have a more generous policy towards immigrants. I, unlike many of the lawyers that I work with, whose work I respect deeply, I am not someone who feels that our population is threatened by the large numbers of people coming into the United States. To the contrary, actually, I think we have done a horrific job of receiving refugees, for example, to use a slightly different population, whether from Syria or Afghanistan. And the countries who are in the least well financially situated to receive the huge numbers of refugees from Syria are now overwhelmed with refugees. So I actually think a more fluid border policy, a more open border policy, would be a much better policy. I also think this notion of anchor babies or of not allowing people to bring their family members who are parents, siblings, et cetera, is absolutely a misdirection. And it violates, we say we are a country that supports families and supports children, and yet our policies operate absolutely against such beliefs.
Tom? If I can interject something, too. If we want to look at the immigration issue and we want to start making changes in the number of immigrants coming to this country, we need to take a long, hard look at American foreign policy in those countries, because that's largely what's driving the people out of there. The people don't want to leave their homes. As a rule, they don't want to leave their homes and come to a place not knowing what dangers meet them on the way here and what they're going to face when they get to this strange country. And a lot of it is due to our foreign policy.
One of my concerns is that whatever policy you want to set now, when you have inegalitarianism around the world, that is one of the chief drivers of populations that flee where they, most populations are pretty happy to stay where they are. People are proud of their surroundings, their place. They make homes and have roots there. They have cultures and traditions. If they're fleeing, it's often because there is either danger, war, oppression, but also inegalitarianism, just economic inequality. And what I don't see is any kind of systemic change that's coming that would mitigate the large numbers of fleeing that we're seeing. How do you feel about that construct? Do you agree that that's a big driver of this?
Yes, I think that in point of fact, I agree with Tom that the policies that we had in Latin America when there was such instability and armed conflict and U.S. involvement and overthrow of sometimes democracies and sometimes not were critical push factors. Now economic issues are a massive push factor, as well as youth gangs and trafficking, violence, more broadly speaking, sexual violence against women. I think that some of the so-called economic plans, like the Alliance for Prosperity that was supposed to inject millions of dollars into Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, those funds, first of all, they went to the already privileged. They went to economically well-positioned people. But secondly, it wasn't enough money to make a drop of difference in the inequality in those countries. So yes, I think that poverty is driving a lot of movement. I agree with you that most people that I know, and Tom said it also, want to stay where they are. They like their countries. They like home. But also, there's a large number of young people who, like I was, they're adventurers. They want to discover the world. They want to be a part of a different reality. And I think if we look at the number of people on the move, we can accommodate those people on the move if we had policies and practices that would accommodate them.
All right, let me grab a listener phone call. This is John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. I just wanted to make a comment on illegal immigration, illegal immigrants. I support Donald Trump and his desire to have these people obey federal law and get this country on the path of being a lawful country again. It's out of control. And I got to tell you, as an example of how damaging illegal immigration is, Cesar Chavez, who's an icon of the union movement, the United Farm Workers, took a very positive approach against illegal immigrants. He actually, on the border, supported union workers and soldiers and police to apprehend illegal immigrants, because he realized that they're hurting the American worker, low-wage American worker, by oversupplying labor to this country. So I have to disagree with a lot of what your guest has said today.
John, thanks for the phone call. Brenton, go ahead.
Thank you for your comments. First, I'd just like to argue that I think it's critical that we don't refer to anybody as illegal. These people may be unauthorized migrants, but I think
they're illegal. They're violating federal law.
Actually,
wake up.
They have crossed the border without proper authorization, but they are not breaking laws beyond having done that. But the second thing is, I think Cesar Chavez, it's a wonderful example that you gave. We're living in a different historical moment with different dynamics and with different labor needs. I think it's an economist could better address some of the questions about how wages are being affected by the presence of the migrant population. But I don't think that the evidence is on the side of the argument as you made it.
You have, Tom, you want to weigh in on some of what you heard?
I was just going to say that the immigration issue has so many misconceptions that have been formalized over the years about the immigration that we have to this country. RACLIS hosted quite a few informative sessions on immigration and how people that are coming from these countries are affected, and it's open to the public so we can have a dialogue and we can educate each other on how we might face this problem.
I want to stay on the subject of immigration because our guest Brenton Likes has written, among many other things, about the impact of legal vulnerability on family context. So, you know, that, for example, is a paper that you wrote for Hispanic Journal of Behavioral Science. So let's talk a little bit about that. The impact of legal vulnerability, which is apparently a very hard word to say, on families. Tell me what your work has told you about that.
One of the important findings of that research, and actually it came up in a workshop this morning, is that there are many, particularly Spanish-speaking families in the United States who are U.S. citizens and who actually have legal status within the country. But the current policies and practices of the U.S. government have a ripple effect, what you might call they move well beyond the communities who may be in the country without proper authorization. Secondly, children born in the United States are U.S. citizens, and many hundreds of thousands of children live with one or two unauthorized parents in their families. And so these children have legal access to education, to health care, but often their parents are afraid to bring them to school or to give them access to the health care that they are entitled to because they're afraid of being separated from the child if they get stopped by the police, who in many states will then hand them over to ICE and they can be deported. So that vulnerability of the child and of the family is not just for people who don't have appropriate documentation, but it extends into the Spanish-speaking, in this case, community. And those are the populations we worked with. But we also see it in the Brazilian community and in other linguistic communities.
Okay, and again, to return to the subject of PTSD, do we see any kind of trauma or at least related sort of how we classically understand the impacts of trauma, whether it's on children, adults, et cetera?
Well, we certainly see it when there are raids, whether they're workplace raids or there are agents who show up at a home and arrest a father or a mother. And we see in children anxiety, bedwetting, regression to behaviors of much younger children, inability to concentrate, fear to go to school, that someone is going to pick them up. Secondly, I just want to put in a plug for the difficulty for teachers, because teachers are in a very complicated situation because it's not legal in most states to ask about status of a child, and yet you have children in your classrooms whose parents are unauthorized. And so when you're looking for parent participation in the school, for example, most of these parents don't feel comfortable participating in the school, but it is seen as a negative if the parent's not involved in the school. So it has a whole host of ramifications well beyond the nuclear family.
All right, I want to read just a quick note passed on by producer Megan Mack, just to back to John's question on the impact on the economy. NPR addressed the question, have immigrants taken jobs from and lowered wages for American blue-collar workers? The short answer from NPR, and I'll read it in full. Economists disagree whether or how much an influx of immigrants depresses wages. Some have found that new immigrants depress wages for certain groups, such as teenagers or workers with a high school diploma or less. Others say the overall effect on the economy is tiny, and an influx of immigrant workers vitalizes the economy overall. Either way, the forces driving wage reductions for blue-collar workers go far beyond just immigration. That's NPR. So, John, I hope that helps there. Here is Cindy, who writes to us and says, doesn't like the term illegals either. She says, undocumented residents are only guilty of a misdemeanor like jaywalking, and they are not criminals. That is from Cindy. So
thank you, Cindy.
So down to our last 90 seconds or so, I want to tell you again, Tom Ward, do it in 30 seconds or less, what you want people to know about tonight.
To come to Gates Presbyterian Church to the Rakla Beans and Rice Dinner to honor Brenton Likes and our two local organization winners.
5:15, Gates Presbyterian Church, doors open tonight. That's on Wegman Road. And you can get more information on Rakla's website, rocla.us, that's R-O-C-L-A. So in our last minute, I just want to ask you some of the concepts that you have worked on, understanding how to work with populations in different countries from different cultures, not just westernizing a standard or Americanizing a standard. That is certainly pertinent to your field. Can it be pertinent to all of us who want to build a better world but don't work in psychology, don't travel to work side by side with those populations? How can we apply those ideas?
I think they have enormous relevance here in the United States. I personally worked in the post-Katrina context in New Orleans. Paul Farmer, who's a medical anthropologist, talks about the construct of pragmatic solidarity. Solidarity is a construct that comes out of liberation theology, and it talks about walking with people hand in hand. Pragmatic solidarity addresses this economic issue that you were talking about and says we have to redress some of these gross economic inequities. Mary Watkins talks about what she calls psychosocial accompaniment. We don't have to be a psychologist to listen to people with empathy and walk alongside them.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to be here. Brinton Likes is co-director of the Center for Human Rights and International Justice and a professor of applied developmental and educational psychology at Boston College, a proud activist as part of the title as well, who has traveled the world and in Rochester today to receive the award, the White Dove Award. Thanks for taking the time to be on the program today.
Thank you very much for hosting us.
And Tom Ward, who is also from Rockla. Nice having you as well. Nice to see you. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Evan.
All right, short break. More Connections coming up.